So I will try in my presentation to cover some points regarding why do we need an updating guidelines and what are the important changes in the latest guidelines and do they really help in real life and this poses implementation challenges. I always like to start with the slide that we know that asthma is a complex disease. It is a heterogeneous disease with variable airflow limitation, as Gina have redefined it, and that it has different and various clinical presentations and phenotypes. There are things that we know are present, like airway inflammation, which is reflected as airway hyperresponsiveness and airway obstruction, but there are phenotypic variations. We see differences in natural history. We see children with asthma who outgrow their symptoms as they grow up. We see people who persist, children who persist in their asthma. And even in terms of longevity, there is some variations in the risk of adverse outcomes. Some patients or children can die of asthma. If we get two patients of the same degree of severity and the same degree of control and give them medicine, we don't expect that the response must be the same in the two. So there is variations. This perhaps reflects the variability and phenotypic variations of the inflammation underlying the disease. We know there is eosinophilic asthma. Less commonly, there is neutrophilic. Rarely, we might see even post-granulocytic. And this inflammation sits on genetic predisposition, intrinsic variability, which we express as atopy or allergy. And it is reflected as a state of hyperresponsiveness, reversible bronchospasm, or even airway remodeling. Again, these symptoms may vary according to the phenotype, and it is very important for us to decide the phenotype in order to get the best outcome of the disease. Now, talking about the new guidelines, the GINA guidelines, recent updates, our long-term goals of asthma should not only be stopped at symptom control. We aim at symptom control, but in addition, we have to look at risk reduction to minimize future risk in terms of exacerbation, fixed airflow limitation, mortality, and medication side effects. To do so, we need strong partnership between patients and the healthcare provider. We should always ask the patient how they perceive their asthma and what are their goals in their asthma control. Therefore, good communication strategies are essential, considering, of course, the healthcare system, the medication availability, and the culture and personal preferences and health literacy. I always like this ingenious algorithm that shows us that asthma is a cycle. Management is a cycle. First, we diagnose asthma, and since the majority of our treatment are inhalers, we start by teaching the patient the different inhalation techniques to see what preference the patient have, and then we prescribe medication. We try after prescribing medication and treat modifiable risk factor. We have to get the patient back again in a certain time, 1 month, maybe 6 months, it depends on the patient, in order to review the response. And in reviewing the response, we look at symptoms, exacerbation, side effects, possible side effects for medicines, patient satisfaction with the treatment he's taking, and perhaps we put some objective measures like lung function or spirometry or peak flow meter. And then we reassess again, and the cycle goes on. We are also familiar about the five-step program of GINA, in which we start with an early introduction of inhaled corticosteroid low dose and step up the treatment by increasing the dose or adding a therapy like LABAs or perhaps antileukotrienes. And then in the latest, we can consider biologic therapies like omalizumab. What are the changes that happened in 2017? We have three changes. One of them, considering ICS even earlier. So even when GINA removed the term chronic inflammation from the definition of asthma, it is still there, appreciated by saying, consider giving small dose because early introduction of ICS had been shown to reduce exacerbation and improve outcomes of the patients. Second change was the introduction of tiotropium since 2014 as a mist inhaler, first approved for children over the age of 18, but now for the age 12 and over. And the third is the introduction of other biologic therapies besides omalizumab, that is the anti-IL-5 therapy. We have the mepolizumab, and we have also this year restalizumab IV. Long awaited, and after persistence asking the GINA, the immunotherapy was included in the treatment algorithm of GINA. First, it was only kept in the appendix, but now it is present, but under certain limitation and restrictions. We consider immunotherapy and sublingual immunotherapy in adult patients who are dust mite sensitive and whom having also a comorbid allergic rhinitis, provided that their lung function is over 70%. These are the indications approved by GINA regarding SLIT therapy. Now, how to assess severity? Very simple ways we can judge. Asthma severity can be assessed retrospectively from the level of treatment required to control symptoms and exacerbations. For example, if my patient is controlled, and when I say controlled, he doesn't have symptoms, he doesn't wake up in the night to use an inhaler, he doesn't use a rescue medicine more than twice a week, and he doesn't have any limitation in his activity. This is a controlled patient. If this is achieved by a low-dose steroid or an antileukotriene, this is a mild patient with asthma. If he needs a step three, like giving the patient a LABA-ICS combination, this is a moderate case of asthma. If we give him a higher doses or even triple therapy, or even he is not controlled under such situations, we say that this is a case of severe asthma. When we should assess severity after the patient has controller treatment for several months, and remember, severity is not static. It's not a tattoo on the arm of the patient. It can change. And remember that it may change over months or years or as different treatments become available, like the weather. It could be mild asthma, and then comes the cloud of severe asthma at one point. How to measure the asthma control? We have simple tools. We don't need a bunch of laboratory diagnosis. We do the asthma control test and the GINA-defined asthma control questionnaire. The asthma control test, we all know it. It's the five questions based on the symptomatology of the patient and the patient perceivement of his quality of life and his asthma control. So we get this five marks, and if the patient gives the maximum of five, so it's 25, he is totally controlled, and we consider the patient is well controlled if the ACT can go down till 20. If it is low, less than 20, 19 and below, then the patient is uncontrolled. In the USA in the year 2009, it was published a study on 10,139 patients. They randomized selected asthmatic patients. 95% were controlled according to the ACT score, and 41 were not. Maybe I have repeated the same methodology in Egypt for about 1,000 randomly selected patients, and I found the reverse. In 78%, they were uncontrolled. And I would confess that the reason is the use of inhaled corticosteroids are not regular. When a patient says, I'm taking ICS as needed, he's not on controller treatment. And the other reason is the increased use of short-acting rescue medication as treatment. They overuse Ventolin, and this gives them a very poor mark. How frequent do you use the Ventolin to relieve your symptoms? Actually, this is a very elegant study. It was made by our chairman, Dr. Julie Bahous, and published in 2009 in five Near East countries, Jordan, Kuwait, Lebanon, Oman, and the United Arab Emirates. And you can see from these figures that those patients who has poorly controlled asthma, that is a score of less than 14 on the ACT score, or those who are not well controlled from 15 to 19, had much higher possibility that to go to hospital and have ER visits because of acute severe exacerbations. The numbers are very high, denoting that we are not doing the best to our patients in our region. This is how GINA assesses asthma control in the four simplified questions: the daytime symptoms, the nighttime awakening, the reliever need, and the any activity limitations due to asthma. So if the patient now doesn't have symptoms except very mild once or twice, if he uses Ventolin once or twice a week, if he doesn't wake up any day for a reliever because of asthma attacking him at night, and he doesn't have work absenteeism or school absenteeism, I would say this is a well-controlled patient. If one skips, then he is partly controlled. If two skips, partly controlled. But if he has three of these questions answered yes, then he is poorly controlled. Previous guidelines have shown that this is linked with the lung function, but the thing is we don't do it in every patient, and we don't need to do it. We do it only to assess the risk for exacerbations. And as you see, they were colored green, yellow, and red. It's quite like a traffic light. So I see a patient in my office either in an acute exacerbation. This is a red light because he has acute exacerbation. And second, I might see him uncontrolled, partially controlled, or controlled. If he comes to me in exacerbation, I treat the exacerbation and step up the controller treatment. If the patient has uncontrolled or partly controlled, I go further to step up the controller. If the patient has achieved control for at least 3 months, I would consider stepping down and go to the lowest dose to maintain. The aim of our treatment is not to achieve control, but to maintain the control in these patients. In that situation, we move along the 5 steps. It's like a traffic light. Unfortunately, this picture was taken in one of the streets in the districts of Cairo. We have the traffic light, the red, the yellow, and the green illuminating together, and this resulted in a traffic jam. And that's what exactly will happen if I make a chaos in this table. Let us take an example. Miss X, Miss Zena, 18 years old student. She has asthma. This is a real-life patient I used to treat. She has asthma since childhood. She recalls repeated asthma attacks, frequent school absenteeism, frequent night awakening, several antibiotic courses, repeated oral steroid courses, salbutamol nebulization consumption, and limited sports activity. How does that sound? Very uncontrolled, poorly controlled patient. So eventually, what happens to an uncontrolled patient? 6 months ago, she had a severe exacerbation that ended in hospital ICU. This is inevitable. It can happen for uncontrolled patients, where she stayed for 10 years, and she was intubated because it was a life-threatening attack of asthma. Upon discharge, she got better. She learned the lesson, and we put her on a LABA ICS combination, 250 microgram of salmeterol fluticasone, which she used on a regular basis, and she learned exactly the technique, and she was very, very compliant because she didn't want to repeat her bad experience. What happened next? She improved significantly. Her ACT score became 22, and over the last 3 months, when she came to us on a monthly basis, she stated that she felt much better, only very mild symptoms, only once a week, no night awakening, resumed ordinary activities, including tennis and swimming, and used Venturin only once last month. What do you say on this type of control? I think this became now a well-controlled asthma. So what is her current level of control? Current level of control, I would say without hesitation, after following a controller treatment, is a well-controlled. What action she is expecting from me? I put now the answer of 7 doctors. And we'll see which one would you vote for. The first one, continue on your treatment. Second, step up to a higher level. 3 and 4, step down. 5, step down to LABA. 6, switch to antileukotriene. 7, to switch to PRN treatment. And I will start to face, first, do you think this patient now requires a step up of treatment? So I think stepping up to higher ICS LABA, because the ICS LABA saved her, doesn't mean you have to increase the dose so long you are keeping, she is controlled on the 250. You don't give her the 500. This answer is considered wrong. I did my job for 6 months. Is that enough? I turn him back to PRN treatment with Venturin? Definitely no. This is a lesson that we should never get her back on a PRN Venturin, and this is a wrong answer. They told me that this is the patient's words, that your inhaler has cortisone in it. Why not I use ELABA only? Can you use ELABA only to maintain control in asthmatic patient? No. Never, because this will mask the inflammation. So this answer, again, is very wrong. Can you switch ELABA ICS combination? Stop it for an antileukotriene? The only thing, if the patient wants to stop inhaler to use an antileukotriene, is those who are using low dose of ICS. They can be switched to antileukotriene. But patients who use medium to high doses with ELABA cannot go 2 or 3 steps down in one shot. So this answer in this particular patient, no. So we are left with 3 doctors now. Maybe one of them is correct. People, after 3 months of control, wants to step down. And you can step down either by removing the ELABA, keep the ICS, or lower the ICS dose and keep the ELABA. Both are good step-down techniques. Would you vote for that? In older guidelines, I may say you may be correct. But in recent guidelines, we are looking at the future risk. A patient who has been intubated 6 months ago should never step down in 3 months. You should wait. So these answers are incorrect. and the patient should go on for longer periods with her current medication, maybe a year before you start thinking if her asthma getting milder and you can step down. And so how do we report our patients has changed? We don't say Zina has good controlled asthma or well-controlled asthma. We say Ms. Zina has good asthma control, but she is at increased risk of future exacerbation because she had severe exacerbation within the last year. With this sentence, she cannot step down her treatment according to the new updates in GINA. Mr. Yahya Urwai has poor asthma control. He also has several additional risk factors for future exacerbation, including low lung function, has a low FEV1, he is a current smoker, and he has poor medication adherence. If I work with Zina a bit, I need to work with Yahya much, much bigger effort to stop smoking, to teach him importance of medical adherence and compliance to treatment, and try to improve his lung function. This is the list of risk factors for asthma exacerbation stated by Gina. Of course, uncontrolled asthma, we don't step down. If the patient had a severe or life-threatening asthma during the last year, if the patient uses SABA in a high dose, and I would say a canister of Venturine contains 200 doses. If he consumes one canister in 1 month, he has a risk for mortality, not exacerbation. He can die out of Venturine. A patient who has inadequate ICS, not prescribed, are not taking it properly, or he is not taking it on a regular basis. A patient who has low FEV1, he's at high risk of exacerbation. If he has a major psychological socioeconomic problems, if he is a smoker, if he is exposed to an allergen, Zina had a cat at home and now she wants to get the cat back and she is very sensitive to cats, this is a bad idea. If she had a comorbid conditions like obesity, rhinosinusitis, confirmed food allergy, or if she had sputum blood eosinophilia, a high FeNO, the fractional expiration for nitric oxide, or pregnancy. These are modifiable risk factors we need to work on. And I really need to avoid this situation. How is your asthma? Just great doctor, can I have more Venturine? One word say it all. This patient doesn't know anything about her disease, and this is not her fault. She's not a doctor. It is the physician's mission to teach the patient that Venturine is not needed for treatment. It is a rescue medicine. In the new GINA guidelines, also it was introduced a new dosage level for steroid by the introduction of fluticasone, furoate, vilanterol as an option for step three. And in this situation, fluticasone, furoate, 100 microgram is considered to be the low dose, 200 micrograms for high dose. And we know that for fluticasone propionate, it is the reverse. And we need, the 500 is the high dose and the 250 is the low dose. So we redefined the dosages based on this new comer, the fluticasone furoate. Stepping down ICS when asthma is well controlled is now evidence A, but it is a step down, not withdrawal. With fluticasone furoate and vilanterol, you can give the medication once daily and have with 100 microgram of fluticasone furoate and equivalence to fluticasone propionate 250, you can get the same. In addition, you give the medication once in a simple device, unlike the other one, you give it twice daily basis. This will have also a reflection on the quality of life, so the patient adherence to treatment will be better, and it will be reflected for improvement quality of life of these patients as well. And this paper by Eric Bateman, who have compared those who are using ICS, fluticasone furoate alone, or adding vilanterol to fluticasone furoate, at the end of 1 year, there is an extra 20% reduction of risk of exacerbations when they use the LABA ICS combination together. The device is simple, and according to the patient preference questionnaire, 94% answered about the easiness of the use. How do you rate the easiness of the use of the inhaler? It came on the top, the Ellipta device. And when they are asked how easily you are able to tell how many doses of medications are left in the inhaler, the answer came in 96% of the patients. Of course, when you give a medication once daily, you expect the compliance to be better than if you give the medication twice daily or three times daily or four times daily. Role of lung function in asthma, we know that we demonstrate variable expiratory airflow limitation, but we reconsider diagnosis if the symptoms and lung function are discordant, meaning that if I get a patient with frequent symptoms and dyspnea and then his lung function almost come back as normal, I should review the diagnosis. He might be a cardiac patient or maybe have a lack of fitness. And if the patient had few symptoms, he doesn't complain, but low FEV1, he may be poorly perceiving his condition and or have a restriction of lifestyle. Low FEV1 is an independent predictor for exacerbation risk, so it's very important also to measure. And measuring the lung function at the diagnosis and every 6 months is quite convenient. Consider the long-term peak expiratory flow rate monitoring for patients with severe asthma or those who have poor perceivement of their airflow limitation. The utility of lung function for adjusting treatment is limited by between-visit variability of FEV1. Those of you who are using the fractional expiration for nitric oxide, there has been slight change in view for FeNO. We know that elevated FeNO in allergic patients has been added to the list of independent predictor factors for exacerbation, but there are other factors, additional factors that increase or decrease FeNO, and that FeNO is not helpful in ruling in or ruling out asthma as defined by GINA. And given the lack of long-term safety, FeNO cannot be recommended at present for deciding against treatment with ICS in patients with a diagnosis or suspected diagnosis of asthma. And if I measure FeNO only at my office, the result of FeNO measurement at a single point in time should be interpreted with caution. It does not reflect the longevity. We all know now that there is nothing called ACOS. There is an asthma COPD, but there is no asthma COPD overlap syndrome. We know that asthma and COPD are two different diseases, but they can clinically overlap. The asthma, there is inflammation, there is mainly eosinophilic, and there is smooth muscle role and basement membrane is thickened, whereas in COPD, we go down the pathology to in the tree to the alveoli with alveolar disruption and fibrosis. In older days, I remember when we say asthma and COPD, we are not sure, we could tell the patient you have asthmatic bronchitis, a term that does not mean his asthma or bronchitis. And then after 8 years of negotiation, at 2014 to be exact, came the GINA and GOLD with this ACOS. The ACOS as the asthma COPD overlap syndrome. But now, since this period of time, some physicians would look at ACOS as being a third, a new disease was invented, the asthma COPD overlap syndrome. Actually, it's no more than asthma overlapping with COPD, and so S is no more needed. The term was being commonly used in the respiratory community as if it was a single disease. Current guidelines have opposite safety recommendations. For asthma, never use LABA without ICS. In COPD, start treatment with LABA and or LAMA without ICS. Sometimes the distinguishing asthma from COPD can be problematic, especially if the patient also is a smoker. But at the end, it is better to avoid this terminology. And the consensus-based description of asthma COPD overlap is intended to provide interim advice to clinicians while stimulating further study of the characteristics underlying mechanism and treatment of this common clinical problem. Other changes I wish to tell you about is also the maternal diet in pregnancy, because there has been a lot of talks about a pregnant woman should not take peanuts, should not drink milk, and things like that. And instead, we know that there is no evidence that ingestion of any specific food in pregnancy can increase the risk of asthma. Instead, maternal intake of foods commonly considered allergenic, like peanut and milk, is associated with a decrease in allergy and asthma in offspring. Therefore, no dietary changes are recommended during pregnancy. Maternal obesity is not wanted, but undue recommendations for weight reduction in pregnancy should be discouraged. Dampness and molds, especially in cities overlying the sea and where there is humidity, can create mold problems, and molds can cause and help in developing asthma, particularly in children spending much time in their homes. When we give oral steroid in short courses, we should always tell the patient and tell their parents that oral steroids are given only for a short period, and we should tell them about the side effects in order to make them immune that these side effects are due to this type of medication. There has been a lot of expectation that vitamin D can revive steroid resistance in some patients, but at the present time, no good quality evidence that vitamin D supplementation leads to improved asthma control or fewer exacerbation. Since Harlovich's paper in 2011 and the Asthma UK, vitamin D as a supplement can improve asthma severity. This is not substantiated. Treatment of chronic sinusoidal disease is important, but we have to stress that it does not affect the outcome. Now, passive smoking and environmental inhalant control is much better than doctors who go and no fish, no milk, no egg. I don't know why people go on very, very aggressively to ask the parents to stop all the nutrient for their children because they cause asthma. Think several times before do milk withdrawal and make sure that it helps not increase the weakness and disturb the immunity of the child. In summary, we are building a new house. We are constructing a new house for asthmatic patients. This construction is based, the basis of this construction is environmental control and patient education. Every patient should learn about the nature of his asthma. Written action plan and follow-up is important. And at the receptionist, at the first level, if they are using a fast-acting bronchodilator, give him a room at the top of this building, not at the bottom of the building. Start with a low-dose inhaled steroid, double the dose, or add a new agent like a LABA, an antinicotinoid, or tiotropium, and leave the top for those with severe asthma and not patients with severe exacerbation in untreated patients. I mean, if I get a patient with severe asthma but he was not treated, this is not a severe asthma. This is a severe symptom in an untreated patient. Then, in these situations, we should give the prednisone or think of the biologics. Remember that with each visit, regularly assess control, triggers, compliance, inhaler technique. Every visit, the inhaler technique should be revised. And look at comorbidities. This is not the construction I was telling you about. It is one of the suburbs in Cairo. I'm afraid this building, I cannot go to the top floor because I think this if has not been fallen already. To conclude, question better. And questioning means questioning about the asthma control and the reliever use. And remember that when you treat asthma and you aim at asthma control, encompass two domains, impairment and risk together. And remember that ICS is the mainstream treatment of asthma, and you may add a LABA or a leukotriene receptor antagonist or a tiotropium in some patients. Consider ICS early and the biologic therapies for severe patients. Always check adherence, inhaler technique, triggers, and comorbidities before stepping up treatment. The low doses of fluticasone, fluid, vilanterol has the advantage of being given once daily, improving quality of life through a simple, easy-to-use device, the Ellipta device. Assess control level and consider future risk before stepping down therapy. Don't go to step down if the patient has a high risk for exacerbation. Written action plan, and remember, we are not yet. After finishing that, I wish to say the guidelines are guidelines, and we have all our experience. But the guidelines serve us to translate the weight of evidence-based. We don't have that much time to read all the literature in order to use it to improve so I would like to finish by saying a person who is treated by the book is likely to die of a misprint. You have to put your input and your experience in it. Because sometimes we go to, not I mean, meaning in the center of Cairo or indicated cities or so, sometimes I go to a remote area and see patients in poor farmers and areas where hundreds and thousands of patients are maltreated. Some of them, their doctors, are resistant, and this is an Egyptian joke when I try to give, this is a famous Egyptian actress, Talat Zakaria, that he was very, very stubborn in using the guidelines in treating his patients. Thank you for
Thank you, Professor Tarraf, for this complete review of the new GINA guideline. The floor is open for question and comment. Dr. Tarraf did his best to do the conference in less than half an hour to keep the floor for comment, discussion, experience. President.
Thank you for your excellent lecture. I have one question in practice. If your patient is well controlled on seretide, do you switch for the new combination, fluticasone, furoate, vilanterol, because of the easier use, improvement in quality of life, once daily administration?
I would say practically, if the patient is satisfied by taking the inhaler twice daily and he is very regular and adherent and uses it properly, and given the excellent response, I don't see a reason to change. But if the patient start to say, I'm fed up, I'm taking the inhaler twice daily, it doesn't help me too much, sometimes I forget it, and this is very common in our practice, I would prefer to shift to a once daily. And this is an experience I gained when I give a patient with hypertension a drug given twice daily or one tablet per day and come back after 6 months. I usually find the patient who is taking one tablet keeping on the medication. But those who are disturbed by a breakfast treatment, noon treatment, and night treatment, and remember that these patients may have another comorbidity and taking other medicines like rhinitis, maybe having GERD. So in my opinion, giving more doses are against the compliance. And the other thing is that when we give fluticasone furoate can give the same level of control like fluticasone propionate 250. So 100 equals 250. So I'm giving the patient a lower dose of steroid, and this can be translated into safety as well. Thank you.
If I may comment on this subject, and I think when you have a machine which is running properly, please don't stop it. You can get into trouble. Yes.
Nabil Samara from Jordan. First of all, do you believe in de-escalation of therapy once your patient is well controlled? Taking into account that we're in a developing country, I like the last slide you have placed in there, that patients, they can't afford much of therapy. So if you know your patient and when you can de-escalate and you can, teach him what to do, probably we can do that. And we have seen it succeeding even in patients with a severe form of the disease.
Yes, thank you for the question. And the de-escalation, of course, I don't think anybody in the audience would vote against de-escalation. Everybody would like to lower down the dose. The problem in our practice is I put the patient on the third floor of the building, and when he feels better, he stops the medications. He jumps from the third floor into the ground. I don't feel that he will go down. So what the message is, we do de-escalation, but stepping down the treatment is as important as stepping up the treatment. And you have to be very careful if the patient has a risk factor. What I mentioned, the message I'm giving today, I would slow down my thinking of de-escalation or stepping down if the patient still has a risk factor for a high exacerbation, meaning that he had a severe exacerbation, some of the asthmatics really are smokers, if you are exposed to allergens, I would be a little bit reluctant against de-escalation. But de-escalation is part of the management of asthma because we call in asthma steps. If I translate that into COPD, for example, COPD now we appreciate de-escalation, although at one time the COPD was described as stages, not steps. And the difference is stages is like on the first, second, third, fourth, and death. This was the COPD description in this century. Now with the new gold guidelines, we have the possibility to de-escalate even with patients with COPD. So de-escalation, I think, in asthma is very important. And again, the problem of financially supporting the patient or the patient cannot afford, we can go to some... I'll tell you a very example, practical point from Gina. Gina says that short-acting should only be reserved for rescue medication. But when it came to low countries of low resources, a combination like the clinial composite, I don't know if you know this the older one with the Ventolin in it, can be given to poor patient if he cannot afford to take a more expensive medication. But again, before doing such a step, I always do a cost-benefit ratio, because if I try to step down to a cheaper medicine and the patient have a severe exacerbation, he will spend much more money in the hospital in terms of unnecessary antibiotics, doctor's fees, ICU fees, and a lot of this money can be saved by taking a proper, potent controller treatment. Thank you.
And assessing our patient is not enough to see if he's controlled. To step down, it's very important to assess risk factor. This is very important, and I think most of us was not doing this. But this is very important in the decision to step down.
Dr. Julia, I would like to ask you about the study you did in 2009. You have shown quite depressing figures that the majority of patients have either poorly controlled or not well controlled, and only few were well controlled. What do you do for this?
I think that the problem is worldwide. Definitely in our area, it is more important due to the fact, first, that people still now, after 25 years of fighting the problem of asthma, people does not like to hear the word of asthma. So there is a negative approach to it. Second, there is a problem of inhaler. And third problem is the inhaled corticosteroid. People are afraid from cortisone. They discard, we give you inhaled corticosteroid, and as you mentioned very well, medication in asthma is one inhaled corticosteroid, two, three, four is always inhaled corticosteroid. And we have problem with our patient to convince them that this should be the case and should be done properly. And there is, I think we have to admit that not only the patient are underestimating the gravity of the disease, physician in at least in Lebanon, we know we are not doing our job of education. And this goes with the system. Our Lebanese system is a private system. We don't have the backing that in England, in Canada, and maybe in USA also they have. They have nurses who can teach. So we are running for out of time. And usually we think that the patient is doing properly his inhaler and he's not doing it. Taking it the way it should be in time and in frequency. So these all are a problem which has to be really tackled slowly but surely. Any other questions or comment? So we'll close this session and we'll thank Professor Tarraf for his nice, beautiful review.